I want to tell you about my next speaker. He's real. Those who've had the chance to spend some time with him in Memphis know what an incredible gentleman he is, what an intellect he is, what a fantastic and courageous individual he is. He has been working very hard on websites translating many of the historical works about these issues, the works of Douglas Reed, many of his articles. And, in fact, some of the works he's had Mosh even do translations for from the Russian and into Russian. And he has also been a person who for years has stood up and fought for the rights of the people in Denmark and the rights of Europe to be free. Now, this conference, the reason why I'm bundling these speakers together right now is because the first part of the morning we've been really talking about our rights and what happened to us here in Memphis, Tennessee. And it's so important. It's so important that we talk in general about what's happening in Europe and around the world. Knut has not only been an intellect, and it's easy to be an academic somewhere in a room, typing in a secure place, sitting somewhere. It's hard to be someone who speaks and writes, but he does it in public. A while back, just a few months ago, he might even mention some of this to you, I did a speaking engagement for my book, Jewish Supremacism, in its new Spanish edition. In Spain, we went to Barcelona, we went to Madrid, we went to Valencia, a number of different places, and he was right in the middle of it. And the communists were coming out, threatening us. I mean, it wasn't just threats. I mean, they were literally in the street with baseball bats, and they were bashing in street windows. They put a number of police officers in the hospital. They threatened to put us in prison. They threatened to put Pedro Varela, who was running these things, in prison. And this academic, this quiet, soft-spoken gentleman was right in the middle of it, right with these terrible characters like me and Pedro Varela. And that's the kind of people who are going to change the world. We need intellects, but we also need men of courage. And this is Knut Eriksson, a man of courage and intellect. Thanks a lot.
Hi, I'm pleased to be here. I've been witnessing the events the past week, and after listening to the other speakers here, I was thinking of something that was interesting to me, a list or a hierarchy of freedom of speech where it seems like still maybe China is at the bottom. I'm not quite sure anymore. But I was used to thinking that America was at the top. I'm not so sure anymore. And Denmark is somewhere in between. And it's probably true, like what Mr. Fromm said, that that Denmark is after Canada, then comes Germany, and that's then all the way down to China, actually, very quickly from there on. Because Germany seems to be the center of the most crazy bit of legislation, crazy bit of suppression of free speech that you can think of, except just shooting people, you know, right off. And so let me introduce also from my side Dr. Duke, that I got to learn about 1.5 years ago. And now I regard him as a very good friend, plus a very valuable, a unique individual for our cause and for the world. So for that reason, I'm very honored to be here with you at this time, this historic time. Mr. Obama is not historic for me, except that, okay, they came all this way, and not Mr. Obama, but the Jews handled that. And when I say the Jews in this speech, and I'm going to say it a few times, because they are also at the center of this, even more at the center than the Germans, because they're behind the Germans. They've taken over Germany again. I don't obviously talk of all Jews. I have to put in that a bit of precaution, because you always attacked afterwards. You just mentioned the Jews and so on. But it's the, I call them the extremist Jews, or the power Jews, or the Jewish supremacists. That word would be very impossible to say in Danish, so I've gotten used to saying just the power Jews. So my speech is really about the legal madhouse of anti-racist Europe. And since I have about 20 minutes, I have to be a bit shorter than I had planned. Dr. Duke yesterday told me that what I had planned was 1.5 hour speech. And just before your lunch, I think that would kill you, maybe. So we don't want that. What I can do, what I can say is that I have made my manuscript, and I'm going to put it on the internet at my website. One of them is the dodo.info. The dodo, you know, was the bird that became extinct in the 17th century, 1683, I think it was. The last one was I use it because the dodo is extinct, of course, but also because it was known as a very friendly bird, and it tasted very well. And those two things did not go very well together. It's said that you could walk right up to a group of dodos down at the Mauritius, where they ended up, and you could just, the Portuguese sailors there were the people who came by there, they could just walk up to a group of dodos and just stamp one of them to death, and the others would go, hey, what was that? Oh, it wasn't me, you know. So they would go on, yapping away. And so that is one of my websites, thedodo.info. The other one is, as Dr. Duke said, that is an honor to another great human being, Dr. Sweet, that you might know. You might have read his book, the most famous book. He's written several books, but the most famous one is The Controversy of Zion, and I put .info behind that. And that's the website which honors him, and I'm trying to put it in as many languages as possible. So if anybody here has the ability to translate into his own funny language, or help me in any way, know somebody who can do it, that would be a great help, because I think that one of the things we have to do today is focus. You can do so many things, and they're all interesting, they might all help a little or a lot, but you have to find out, where is the power that you want to support? Where is the sensible, really unique way of putting these things that you need to reiterate again and again? So my choice has been to assist David Duke now as the most interesting person at the moment, who really focuses on what is the problem and not going, way out in the universe or to all these weird groups. And also, you will see if I get far into this, that you might fall asleep from just listening to how many treaties, how many laws, how many regulations you can come up with. And I tell you, in the EU, it's not in the thousands, it's in the millions. It's so many that the heads of state, when they pass these treaties and just say, yeah, okay, go ahead, we're going to put the dumb people to vote on it, they haven't even read it. That was the case with the latest plebiscite, the latest, what do you call it, plebiscite?
Plebiscite.
In Ireland, where they actually were allowed, this is not normal, you're even allowed to vote on this. Now, it was a plebiscite. And they were, as I think, the only country in the European Union allowed to vote whether they wanted this latest extension treaty called the Treaty of Lisbon. And they all have these names that you cannot make your way through, and it's Lisbon, or it's Malaga, or wherever. So you really get lost in all these treaties and legal things. And that's the idea, of course. So I'll try to tell you why I have chosen to come here. Well, first of all, I was very honored to be invited here. And about 1.5 years ago, about the same time, a little bit before actually, I took part in another conference in Hillsborough. And that was also interesting to go out of your own country, because I used to be a nationalist, you could say, for a while, trying to save Denmark from all these multiculturalizing efforts there. And after a while, I had to realize that that was impossible. We're a small nation, only 5 million, and they're almost asleep, all of them. That doesn't give you a lot of chance. I still hope that we can have something after some years that we could call Denmark, but it will never be the same. They have loaded in, I would say, up to 1 million Muslims. They will never admit that. As you know, with everything else, they lie about how many there are, what they're doing, how nice they are, and everything. But in our part of the world, it's Muslims. It's from Turkey, it's from Pakistan, it's from this whole region from the Near East. And of course, my stand on that is, I don't hate these people at all. I'm not really against them. I know several of them that are quite nice. But it's a matter of statistic that they have such a fantastic crime rate that just that fact alone makes them not very welcome in my home, my country. So from being a nationalist trying to save Denmark, I said to myself and a few others, no, this is not going to work. We have to team up, really. We have to team up with the people who are efficient out in the world, because we are so few, and if we want to handle anything in this line, we must find where are the people who are already a power, who make sense, and who you can respect. So that's how I met Dr. Duke. I think he is fantastic at his courage, the way he has to put up with stuff. Now I saw it for myself. It's so incredible. And it's also hurting to see, because you see these other people who try to get their views out, how courteously they are met, you know. But not with us, not with Dr. Duke. That's a different case altogether. And but still, I found out that if I wanted to have any results at all, I had to team up with people like him and like you. And I'm very honored to be here for that reason. Now, so since I have to make this simple, and actually I do like to make things simple, because in simplicity you find the truth. It's only when you must lie, things get very complicated and not really understandable. So the trouble is that if I have to give you some information, just apart from saying what I'm saying now, is the whole legal madhouse of anti-racist Europe, which is the title of my speech here today, is really very, very simple, because it's a Jewish racket. That's all it is. And on top of that, you have to name things for what they are, and after that you can get complicated if people like that. It's fantastic how they have enveloped this little simple fact into treaties and laws and books and what have you. But when you come down to the bare facts of it, it's simply that one way of silencing people is to put them in jail, of course, at least for 5 years, as they've come up to now in Germany. They're working on it. Okay. It's going to be more. But 5 years, they think, is a beginning. And it's probably what you could call their humanitarian alternative to simply having the Mossad go and hit the man. And since that is really what I think it is what they think of as an alternative, a humanitarian alternative, you know, to having people suicided or accidented. that is the framework we'll have to see it in, really. It's terrible, but that's what it really is. It is not complicated law or legal afterthoughts about how should we prevent racism in Europe. That's what they have made it into, of course, and it has taken many years. So, first of all, I will just remind you that it is not totally taken out of the blue to say that it is an alternative to having the Mossad come. You know, in Austria, we had a very interesting case, because in Austria, there was a little country that somehow got up to having a protest movement of up to 30%. This last time, it was 30%. The last time... Last time it was 27%. And I don't know if you remember what happened then, but first of all, Israel called its ambassador back. That was too much. That was really... That was disgusting, of course, you know? That people should talk and should talk like that. They got a government which included Jörg Haider and his Freedom Party, and Europe could not allow that. So a lot of things went into action from that point on. Of course, a lot of it was already in place, like a Stasi-type observation center that was all there to denounce people and to take on the legal cases against them if they said anything. State-supported, of course. But the EU organized through their normal channels, through more unconventional channels, like they had a conference in Stockholm in the beginning of 2000, and this government of Austria came into function, I think it was also in January maybe, the election was just before that in 1999. And this conference in Stockholm was around the Holocaust. But they managed to make some deals. It was heads of states and other important people who were there, and they decided we cannot have this. We have to have sanctions against Austria, and so they came from already from February of 2000. So now you saw the second time this happened. Now we're in 2008. So what happened now? You all remember that Mr. Haider was accidented. It is not possible to say exactly yet. I have not been following the latest articles on all this, but it is strange and interesting how people suddenly become very clumsy or lose the zest of life when they get in the way of Israel and their agenda. And of course, it's not only my guess, it's something that is totally out in the public. Immediately after this happened, people were speculating, the rumors were that this is a Mossad hit. Mm-hmm. The family thinks so too, and they are having Mr. Haider, this is maybe already happened now because I haven't been following the news for the last week or so, but the family is having him autopsied in Italy, because they don't even trust the Austrian doctors, apparently. And I don't know what is coming out of this, but just the fact that the rumors are so strong that this is a Mossad hit is a very, very serious thing for Israel and for the Jews. So they have to be a little bit careful as yet, because you don't know how things are going to be in 5 years or 10 years, because as they desensitize the public to political murders, and as you get this Jewish mafia, so-called Russian mafia, moving into Europe and all over the world, it's going to be that much easier to just have people killed, and there'll be so many that the police cannot take hand of it, and the rest of us will just say, okay, another one. But let us notice now, when it's still something which is not quite polite to kill people off you don't disagree with, that we have this alternative, and that's all it is, the legal madhouse of Europe. they made all these conferences and treaties to gradually build up based on the word racism, of course. And slowly they put into that anti-Semitism. They always hide behind something. And in this case, it started out with the word racism. If I look in my old, very nice edition of Encyclopedia Britannica, I think it's still known to be the best in the world, and it's from 43. The word racism does not even exist in that encyclopedia. It does not exist. And then yet, I could go right up to now and say two young people sitting in jail in Denmark now are awaiting extradition to Germany after, according to this new European arrest warrant, which is based on an act of racism they're said to have committed. So from that point in 43 till now, we have 65 years. In that short period of time, we have a thing which does not exist as a concept. Of course, you might talk of races then, you might talk of enmity among races, but the exact word racism did not exist, and now you have complicated legal systems and a concept of or a crime which is a thought crime for which you can be extradited to 5 years of prison in Germany. And in Denmark, it is not a crime to say what these persons have said. And it's going to be very interesting to see. It's a case which is very parallel to Mr. Tobin, of course not as well known, because they're just two young guys of around 30 years of age. And they're called neo-Nazis, and you know, as I do, that you never know exactly what they are. It's something which they've sung a song, you know, like the Horst Wessel Lied, then they're a neo-Nazi. So, in any case, it has been decided now by the Danish Ministry for Justice that they are to be extradited. No doubt about that. There was not even a question of was it also punishable in Denmark. That used to be the case. You had to have it punishable in both countries before they could be extradited. Now that is one of the new landmarks of the European madhouse, that this has been taken away. Now the police just has to get the message from Germany, we want them, and they look through all the things. Is that your name? Okay. And is that true? That is your tape recorder of whatever has committed the crime? Yes. Okay. So you will be extradited. They lost in the lower court, so now it's been appealed, and we'll have to see if they are extradited or not. But I don't have high hopes, really, because there is this a bit of controversy. We have created it. Me plus a few other guys have created that. But it's that more difficult when they're not famous, of course. So that's the difference, and it is Germany from where all this comes, because of course Germany is still a conquered country, as you probably know. It's an occupied country. It's occupied by Zionists. So that tells you why it's easiest for them to get the laws coming from there. But they're going to work all over the EU, and I think it's going to be very serious before it gets good again. So I'm not going to go into a lot of intricacies about how these laws came about, because you can go to the internet here and see the whole article I had planned for you, and it is interesting to see how it develops step by step. But it's also more to the point when you are all waiting for your lunch to come to the point that this is really what the Zionists are really doing to us is a bit of black magic. And that is astounding, maybe, but you know, you create, you. Cre- You create something, and that develops into something in the physical. Then it could be black or it could be white, according to what's happening. The Jews are really, they are sections. And there's some people who have the dissident called Mr. Barry Chambers, Jeff Renshaw, very often, telling about how he calls them the Sabbateans. Well, they're in power around the world. They are the Zionists. So that he's just saying they are really, they are magicians. That's what they are. They're working at things like that. They're creating something as a concept, putting it into all our minds, and then slowly getting it to work in the physical world. You could call it superstition, you could call it magic, you could call it many things. But it's something that does work because they have the mass media, they have everything behind them, they have all this money. If you have an idea and you can finance it by $20 billion, it's going to work. That's for sure. And it doesn't matter really if it's a lie or if it's true, because after a while, people don't care. It's just what is there, and that is the truth to most people. It's not whether it's correct, whether it's ethical or anything like that. It's that is what is on the show tonight. That is the truth. So I think that you could actually do a lot of research by simply looking at the fact. I must say also Dr. Dirk has been mentioning that. He calls them the Chabad Lubavitch group. And they themselves on their website say that they are the most vibrant, the most vital movement in Jewish life today. So that shows us it's not something very fringe-like. It's not something which they hide in the closets or anything. It's just that the rest of us are not aware of it. We think people cannot be that superstitious or could really believe that they are either Superman or can, you know, create... matter out of thought or something, but it's what they're working at, and we are really sort of a background stage for what's going on, and we just have to what they say. We just have to be the this, what you call that, the pawns in this game. We're not players at all. We're just the pawns. When they want a new movement to go ahead, or they want a new law to get go into action, we don't have any say in that. Now, in Europe, it's true that Germany is the most oppressive country, but I would say that the most research that has been already done there has been done in France for some reason. They have a long tradition of intellectuals who are both on the Jewish side. They've written thousands of books. They also have many intellectuals who have written against the Jews. And in any way, I've had a personal experience with that, which I think I should come to now, because that's it's more interesting. In 97, so that's 11 years ago, I had a chance to go through Europe. I took the chance, took my old car, and I went through most of Eastern Europe to see what had become of it. Because the years of communism had passed by a short while ago, and I was pretty sure I could still see the old communist-type countries, but very soon that would be changed. So that would be interesting for me. And I also laid in a visit to Strasbourg, where I found out they just had a Front National Congress, a very big one, which was one of the... the biggest events where the Front National was at its highest. I used 6 hours to get in there, past all that security and everything, to take part in that. And I had a weekend of very interesting speeches. I listened to Jean-Marie Le Pen. You know, he went on for I don't know how long, but he's good at, you know, going on, and he could really give the Jews what they needed, you know. Plus the communists. I have a quotation here. I'm not going to give it to you now, but you can read that in the article if you feel like it. Yeah, the website was this the Dodo.
You're reaching a huge number.
Right. These two websites, the main websites, I have thedodo.info and controversyofzion.info. Here you will find my article. I had an article actually also right after this Congress in Strasbourg with the Front to interview Jörg Haider, interestingly, right after that. And I didn't have a long time with him, you know, but It was interesting to me, of course, and one of the questions I could put to him was, are you going to work with the Front National? Because that was what they were all about, to get, you know, out to and work together. And he was not quite sure about what happened. Okay, he waited too long, you might say, but he was good in his own right. He probably had to think about if they went down, he would go down with them. So he didn't want that. He was strong enough to do it on his own, I think. That was his thought. But they have a lot of research in France, and there you would be able to find how this whole development from racism didn't exist as a definition up till racism is a punishable crime by 5 years, and all the intermediate steps. I have to come to my end now, something like that.
Well, we're happy to give you even 30 minutes, you know, but 30 minutes is gone now, too. But we appreciate you very much. Please, yeah,
all right.
Take a minute.
I think then, because you got the point now, that there's a lot to be said in between of how you implement these laws, how long you have to wait. First you create a commission. Even before you create the commission, there's going to be a lot of lobbying before you have this commission. And all this I've been through. But in France, they've been following the evolution of this definition from racism to up to today. And a book by a Mr. Jean Moncomble, it's unfortunately only in French, but he has a very interesting thing about that. He says also that in a, let's see, yeah, I'll take it, quote it for you, so I haven't said anything wrong. Okay. I go to the high point of what he says here. The evolution of the word racism in some French encyclopedias. 1933, no mention of the word, just as in mine. 1950 here, it's called a theory, racism. A theory which seeks to preserve the unity of the race in a nation. Then, 1961, it's become a system which affirms the superiority of one racial group over the other, especially presupposing its separation from the others inside a country called racial segregation. 1986, it's now a theory of the hierarchy of races which concludes the necessity to preserve the supposed superior race from any race mixing and its right to dominate the other races. Then in 1987, that's how far the book went, it's become an ideology which confirms the superiority of one racial group over the others, presupposing especially a segregation from these inside a country. That's racial segregation, or even aiming at their extermination now. Genocide, racism of the Nazis. So he says, this French author, he says, what an evolution of the definition. And of course the whole subject of punishing people is because they've taken it from something which did not exist to the point of something which is so real that everything, centers, everything rotates around that today. And people get all afraid when the word is mentioned. That's what they've gotten us to. And that is really a bit of magic, isn't it? To get people who have not even heard of something suddenly go, oh, I'm not a racist. I don't know the word. Okay, and so the Jews, you will see that in my article here. You can take this article, put it on top of the other article I did 10 years ago, and you would have a pretty good explanation of how this all came about. But the Jews are heavily involved in it, and this is totally proven in Mr. Comble's book, and I think also in my articles with the references I have there. But let me say that when we're talking about hate, there was one of the leading philosophers in France who was also very active when I was down there in Strasbourg. He's called Henri Bernard Levi. And he has changed the old famous words, I think, therefore I am, till I hate, therefore I am. That tells you all about it, really, doesn't it? And another, for my finishing words here, I'll just say that another Jewish opinion leader in France, also from this book I mentioned, he said it very succinctly. He said, I'm first a socialist, then I'm French, and only last a Jew. But a Jewish diplomat then came out and said, and this is public in an article or such, he said, it's a good thing that in Hebrew we read everything backwards.
Great.
Thank you.
Maybe I wish we could get that higher. Trying to get some better sound here. So I'll do some housekeeping right now with the convention. We were going to have Don come up now, but I'm glad our speaker spoke a little longer than allotted because the information is so vital and so important, and that was a wonderful presentation, an honest presentation. We're going to, before we do anything, in fact, while I'm talking about a couple of very important issues, I want you to know that in just a few minutes, about 20 minutes, we have lunch coming. It's going to be very beautiful, barbecued, southern barbecued chicken lunch and good vegetables, and we've got soft drinks and other things to wet your whistle here. About half have paid for the banquet, and we're sorry that we're not eating steak at the Whispering Woods. A lot of you haven't paid anything for the banquet, and I hope that all of you can pitch in a little bit and we can cover some of the costs of this. We've had a lot of economic, losses with this conference, as you can imagine. It's been a pretty powerful thing. Maybe we can go and have success in court. We don't know that, though. You know, the courts really aren't in our hands. I hear that from people all the time. Well, they did this to you. Why don't you sue? They broke the Constitution. Why don't you file suit in federal court? You know, to follow the Constitution. Well, as you know, the courts are not in our hands anymore. The courts are absolutely not in our hands. You're not always going to get remedy in the courts. If that were true, why do we have going on what's going on in our society? We are certainly going, and we're going to make an effort to get the damages that we deserve. But the main thing we got to remember is that we have met, we've overcome the opposition of those who tried to silence you and silence me and all of our great speakers from around the world. We have succeeded. We have triumphed. And this message is right now going out around the world. So later in this conference, we'll try to raise a little money to cover some of those expenses. But right now, we'd just like to cover a little bit of the lunch that we've arranged for you guys. So we got two lovely ladies. One of them is my daughter, Kristen, and the other one, I don't have the identity of. And they're going to start from the front and pass and see if we can make some contributions. And I know some of you have already paid and some of you haven't. Some of you are going to help everybody have a good lunch. We're just going to give lunch to everybody here today. So true communism at work, I guess. All right, now I want to talk about a couple of issues in regard to some of our speakers, because I know that I spent about 5 years altogether in Russia. I spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe, and I'd like to accent some of the discussions here and put it in the perspective that I think you can understand from an American's point of view who spent time in Europe. It's very important, I think, we understand what's really happening. And Don, by the way, when we eat here, I want to say this before I get into this issue. When we eat here, we eat in this room. With barbecue, you can need lots of napkins, and we're going to try to make sure you have lots of napkins. We want to stay pretty much, a lot of us, in the room because we want to hold this room. If we leave, like I said earlier, if you don't use it, you can lose it. And we need you to stay in this room pretty much. Enjoy. The air conditioner's working well. Okay, so let's talk about some of the issues. And this is very important for the people listening around the world. We've been so conditioned, when there's ever a word of criticism uttered against organized Jewry, or even Israel today, people often identify it as anti-Semitism. We've been conditioned to treat any criticism even of Israel today as anti-Semitism, to treat any criticism of Jewish extremism as anti-Semitism. And we have people here from France, and we've got people here from all over the world, and this broadcast is going around the world, so we should make a couple things clear. And also, these are good arguments for you to use with your friends, with your family, when they don't understand our position on the so-called Jewish question. Let's take a couple of issues, and then I'm going to talk about a publication of Willis Cardo's, and what we have here that's available for you at this conference, by the way. So let's talk about that, a couple of issues. Our good friend, Knut Eriksson, talked to us much about how, he talked to us very clearly about how there's a great deal of racism or supremacism in the Jewish community. He even mentioned Chabad Lubavitch. Now, when I talk or we talk about Chabad Lubavitch, we're talking about a multi-million dollar Jewish organization with organizations in almost every major city of the United States, Europe, and even around the world. They even have organizations in Beijing, China. They have organizations in many South American cities, Buenos Aires. What is Chabad Lubavitch? Well, Chabad Lubavitch actually meets in the White House of the United States of America. If you read DavidDuke.com, you can see the pictures of Chabad Lubavitch leaders meeting with presidents of the United States, heads of states all over the world, making demands of President Bush, and Bush answering their demands, like, for instance, supporting Israel. And they treat this organization like a great and viable group and a very positive group that we should all listen to. They have teach-ins in the White House. Chabad Lubavitch is an absolutely Jewish extremist organization. You hear a lot about Muslim extremism, and certainly that's a danger in many places of the world. There's another danger called Jewish extremism. Chabad Lubavitch, and you can go to their website. These are things available to you. You can research. Chabad Lubavitch believes, and they state this openly, and their great Rebbe, who was their great teacher, states this openly. They believe, and in their own words, they believe that the purpose of all mankind is to, quote, serve Jews. They say the purpose of every living thing on earth and every human being on earth is to, quote, serve Jews. And that's an amazing quote, isn't it? It's a fact. Now, I'm certain from this broadcast I'll be criticized and said, well, that's anti-Semitic. It's not anti-Semitic to talk and expose intolerance and extremism. You know, it's not anti-Semitic to discuss and expose Jewish supremacism, real supremacism. Yeah. There's not one leader in this room of this movement that has ever said anything like the purpose of humanity is to serve white people, or the purpose of blacks is to serve white people, the purpose of Jews is to serve white people. We don't say those things. We believe every people has a right to their own life, and we're not supremacists. We're not even looking for a society where we have large numbers of minority to pull out the garbage or to do work or serve us. We're looking for our own communities. That's all. Well, to live among our own people with our own values and our own culture. That's not supremacism. That's simply survival and the normal rights that people have. And when you notice the media, when other people around the world do that, when we talk about the threatened existence of the Amazon Indian people, the world applauds and says, yes, they should be able to preserve their culture. And it's a dangerous thing that the Amazon's being burned down and being settled and so forth. That's very dangerous to their culture. We've got to preserve their culture. But when Europeans do it, it's criticized. Chabad Lubavitch, let me give an example of their extremism. One of their main rabbis, one of their main rabbis was quoted not long ago in the largest Jewish newspaper in the United States of America. The Jewish newspaper is called the Jewish Week. In fact, it's pretty much the largest Jewish newspaper in the world. It has more readership among the Jewish community than any other newspaper in the world. And they quote, and they have what they call halakhic law, and columns by all these Orthodox extremist Jewish leaders and rabbis. One of the rabbis that writes and is quoted quite often in Jewish Week made this statement. He said, this is an amazing thing to hear. Some of you have heard it, but this is the kind of thing we got to repeat again and again and again. He said, if a Jew is sick and needs a liver, do we have a moral right to stop an innocent Gentile on the street and take his liver? And he answers, well, according to our Torah and our Jewish law, the answer is yes. Because Jews are of infinite value, and the other people of the world are just chaff.
I wonder if that happened in Brazil.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, think what that means and think of the horror of that kind of a statement. What he basically said is, and this goes to all the listeners around the world out there, you know, who are hearing this right now. He basically said that if you're a non-Jew, if you're a non-Jew, that he believes that Jews have the right to kill you or your wife, or if you're a woman, your husband, or your daughter, or your son, or your mother, or father, or grandfather, and if they need an organ, they just can kill you and take your organ, your liver, or your heart, murder you, because the Jews are of infinite value and everybody else is worthless. That is the most intense racial hatred and viciousness and supremacism you can imagine. You know, I can't. There's no words to express it. There's no words to express it. Now, this guy is one of their chief heads of their mystical parts of the Chabad Lubavitch, of an organization that's allowed to meet and have parties in the White House of the United States of America. And I can show you pictures of their leaders. Their leaders with presidents and leaders in France, in Germany, in Ireland, in England, all over the world. Canada with the prime minister. We've got the pictures. You can go find them on my website. I've got a wonderful letter by a Jewish individual who was head of the Judaic Studies at a major university in Canada. And he literally protested Chabad Lubavitch Center. Chabad Lubavitch actually built a center in near the Toronto area that was financed by taxpayers' money. That's how much control they have over us. Financed by taxpayers' money. And he pointed out, and he's a Jewish individual, authority on this, all right? And he pointed out that Chabad Lubavitch believes that all Gentiles have inferior souls, that Gentiles are meant to be slaves. They openly preach this and teach this. There's a wonderful Jewish website called Dat Emet in Israel. And it's run by Jews, some very brave and courageous Jews, and there are some in the world. My book's dedicated to Israel Shahak, who was he's dead now, but he was a Jewish campaigner who tried to expose this extremism. And he suffered a great deal because of his work in that. And Dat Emet literally quotes from the Talmud. Dat Emet quotes from major Jewish leaders, universities in Israel right now that say things like, one of the articles they have on their website is from a major Jewish academic, a very powerful man in university. The name of the article is, "Only Jews Are Men." In other words, non-Jews aren't even human beings of the world. I remember, and I said this, and I wrote this in my book, there's a famous, famous quote in the thing that Jews always talk about in terms of Adolf Hitler. And this is not a great defense. This is no defense of Adolf Hitler. I'm trying to show you an example of the hypocrisy we have. There's a quotation in Mein Kampf when Hitler talks about encountering Jews in Vienna. And he talks about the captains, you know, and their locks and the way they dressed. And he says they're not quite lovers of water and things of this nature. But he stops and he says, and this is mild compared to what they say. He stops and says, is this a Jew and is this a German? Is this a Jew? Is this a German? You know, it's saying that there are differences in ethnic groups and in heritages. And there are differences between us. He didn't say, is this a German or is this a human? He didn't say the Jews were non-human. He said, is this a Jew, a German? It's a different nationality. Okay? The Jewish extremists say, is this a Jew? Is this a human being? That's a big difference. That's more radical. I point out in my book these things, and these things are irrefutable, and you can check them anywhere you want to check. You know, if tomorrow Tennessee tried to pass a law, we're in Tennessee right now, if they tried to pass a law that made it illegal for a white person to marry a black person, if that happened, there would be absolute revolution in this country. I mean, can you imagine? Every newspaper would condemn it. They would try to block off all federal funds from Tennessee. They would send federal troops down here if they had to change the law. And it would get so much condemnation you couldn't even imagine. But every day, millions of your tax dollars go to Israel, a nation that makes it illegal for a Jew to marry a non-Jew. You cannot legally in Israel marry a non-Jew if you're Jewish in Israel. And it's not just, people often say, well, it's a matter of religion. It's not just religion at all. Let me give you an example. In the Jewish community, you have the Kohanim, which is the Jewish priest class. They consider this to be the most true, pure-bred Jews of all history. And they're often called the Kohens. There's all sorts. You see K-O-H-N, Cohen with a C-O-E-N. And they're part of the old, what they call the Jewish priest class. The same Pharisees, by the way, who led for the crucifixion of Jesus. But anyway, these are what they call the elite, the priest class of the Jews. They're kind of like the Israel's and the Jewish community's SS. They're like the people we've got up here. You know, in Germany you had a group called the SS, which had to prove their purity, their racial purity, four generations back. They had to show that they were pure Europeans four generations back. And of course, they've been really condemned for those kind of laws. But you know what the Kohanim is? The Kohanim actually has to prove their purity 1,000 generations back. They can't have one drop of Gentile blood. Now, this is what's going to be amazing. And I know people around the world are listening to this, and it's so important to understand what's going on here. And I can show you. I've got an article from Jewish magazine, and the name of the article is Not Jewish Enough to Marry a Cohen. And it's about the laws in Israel. And it's about a Jewish boy who's a Kohanim. And it's about a Jewish girl. She's Jewish by religion. Nobody argues that she's not Jewish. She goes to synagogue, you know. But she came from Russia. And there's belief among the Jewish community that back in her ancestry, back in Russia a few generations back, that she's got some Russian blood in her. Oh, my God. And because now she's a Jew by religion, goes to synagogue, but she might have a drop of Russian blood and not be pure Jewish. The Jewish state of Israel would not allow the marriage because she had a drop of Gentile blood, just a drop. Are you beginning to see, are the listeners around the world beginning to see the hypocrisy that we're facing right now in the world? You're beginning to see this incredible double standard about everything? You know, Israel is a, quote, Jewish state. It's a Jewish state. In fact, we had the Congress stand up and say, Israel's got a right to keep its existence as a, quote, Jewish state. What would they say? You know, we're originally a Christian country. Would we be allowed to be a Christian state or a European state? You know, of course not. That's horrible. The thought of that is horrible. Israel has segregation between Jews and non-Jews that's enforced by the state. In fact, you have many settlements which they stole from the Palestinians where a Palestinian who lived there, his fathers lived there, grandfathers lived there, where they can't even walk on that land that was stolen from them. They have segregated schools, segregated apartment buildings, whole villages that have been segregated. But the same government that tells you can't even have your own community or your own schools, you've got to have forced busing and you've got to have anti-white discrimination. It's the same government that has literally billions of your dollars going over to Israel to support this Jewish supremacism. And ironically, you know, I don't think, and we're not supremacists, we're survivalists. We're just people that want to preserve our heritage. Now, there are some white conferences around the world and some groups and some so-called conservative groups. And the great difference, and I think the reason why the Euro conference is the best conference and the most important conference in the world, it's because here at this conference, what you're hearing today is not part of the truth. It's the whole truth. We talk about things a lot of other organizations won't talk about, but it's true, you know. And I'll tell you something. There's no way for us to have victory, whether it be in America or Europe or in the world, until we recognize the power of Jewish extremism. And these extremists that are in the White House celebrating that, you say it's okay to take a Gentile's liver and say that it's, you know, okay all right, that the Jews are the old, should be served by the Gentiles. These extremists are not running around the desert somewhere in Haifa. They're in the White House. They're in the White House of the United States in Congress, behind AIPAC. All these groups, they're all over the world. They're meeting with the President of France today. Hey, what is the President of the United States? One of them, for all I know. He's right with them. You know, it's amazing. They have tremendous power. That's a reality. You know, we're not being hateful, and we're not being supremacists because we expose supremacism. They're the supremacists. They're the radicals. They're the extremists. You know, we had periods of time when the slavery existed in the United States. It was only a tiny percentage of the white people that owned slaves, even in the South. The vast majority of whites never had a slave, not one slave on their property or in their home. It was only about 20% of the population had slaves. In the North, there were many places there were no blacks at all. Yet we are giving a collective guilt for slavery in this country. And we're talked about, they tell us how terrible we are because our ancestors did whatever. You know, but at the same time, if we criticize Jewish supremacy, it's amazing. The Jews in the South, according to Jewish historians themselves and in the country, their average Jewish household in America, according to the Jewish Historical Society, 40% of Jewish households in the United States had black slaves. 40%. Compared to the United States as a whole, or all the colonies, compared to about 5% of our people. Think we would give them collective guilt. How many times have you seen on television or in the media whites being told that we should feel guilty because of slavery? Well, white people enslaved black people, what do you expect? Why shouldn't they face discrimination? White people did this to black people. White people went to Africa. Europeans went and brought blacks from Africa. So why shouldn't you pay the price? How many times have you heard that? A lot of times. They give us a collective guilt. Well, they're whites enslaved blacks. White did this, did that. They give us a collective guilt for slavery. A few years ago, Don Black was with me, and he's going to speak right after lunch. It's going to be a wonderful presentation, and we've got a lot to say about this. But Don Black was with me. I did a program called Black Perspectives in the News. And it was a show in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And it was a very interesting show. It was a black show. And I went on there, and I did a lot of research. Nation of Islam did a lot of research. And if you look at all the major Jewish histories from the history of slavery, inevitably they brag about the fact that the slave trade, since the time of Christ, the slave trade in Europe and in the Americas has been controlled by, quote, Jews. They brag that they've controlled it. They talk about the leading slave center of the slave trade in this country was in Newport, Rhode Island. By strange coincidence, that's where the ships went from. By strange coincidence, that was also the only colony where they could settle in, because the other ones you had to be Christian. And it was the biggest Jewish community in America. And they ran the slave trade. The Jewish historians even list them, and they're proud about this. This is a great Jewish achievement. Okay, so I went on this Black Perspectives of the News program, and I started just quoting from these Jewish historians. And I said, if there's a collective guilt whites are given for slavery, why isn't there a collective guilt for Jews about the enslavement of blacks and Americans? And I'll tell you something, and no one defends slavery, and boy, and Thomas Jefferson, so many other Americans were so right that slavery was a terrible mistake for this country. I think both for black people and for white people. But the worst part, the very greatest crime of the slave system and slave trade was the middle passage by these captains and these rapacious slave dealing firms that brought these people over in their own waste and with terrible disease, and many, many millions died in the passage. The few south, the southern plantations that kept black or African slaves treated them quite well. They were very valuable property. I'm not trying to be rough about this, but they treated them well. They were property. They had their own cabins. They were given a decent life. They were given a Christian life. They certainly were far better off than the slavery they had in Africa. But the greatest suffering that took place was the passage. And the people directly responsible for that horrible passage were these Jewish extremists. Now, I don't say that all Jews should be condemned because this happened, but I hope you're beginning to see the incredible double standards that exist. Now, if we look at the recent presidential campaign, as I said earlier, the biggest contributor to Barack Obama was Goldman Sachs. His chief of staff right now is a Jewish extremist, dual citizen of Israel, whose father was part of the Irgun gang, who was a terrorist. If you look at his contributors, the Democratic Party, enormous numbers of Jews, as were the contributors of John McCain. If you look at the most powerful lobby in the United States government, it's AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. And look at the results of what's happened here, ladies and gentlemen. Saddam Hussein was never a threat to this country. Never a threat. As you probably know quite well. You know, we spent $1 billion of your taxpayers' money to try to make George Bush and the Jewish lobby, the neocons, look good, but they found not a single weapon. In fact, when we were in that country having inspectors going all over the country, I mean literally 1,500 inspectors, and we offered Iraqis $25 million if they could just show us where some of these weapons. Now, we were claiming, if you remember, that thousands of tons of weapons of destruction, bombs and gases and things like that, were buried and hidden in Iraq. You can't bury tens of thousands of tons of weapons without a lot of people involved in it. And we were saying to any Iraqi, and it was publicized, you come forward, you show us where some of these weapons are, and we'll give you $25 million. And you can live as a king anywhere you want to in the world. But strangely enough, ladies and gentlemen, not one Iraqi came forward. There was a lot of evidence there were no weapons of mass destruction. But you see, they couldn't, and I knew this, and many other people knew it. I said this before the war, as you know. I fought very hard to try to stop this war. I traveled the world. As you know, with this war, they couldn't get America to go to war to say, let's go have tens of thousands of Americans die, you know, for Israel, and maybe trillions of dollars expended. No, they had to say, they had to lie to us, the media control and the government, they had to lie to us and say, Saddam Hussein's a big enemy of America. Since when? You know, Saddam was our ally at one time. I can show you pictures of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam. We gave him the supposed weapons of mass destruction, which he destroyed in 1993. But after the war with Iran, which where he was our surrogate fighter against Iran, after that war, he emerged with a very powerful military, and he started really supporting the Palestinians. And he became a big enemy of Israel. And at that point, they began to make Saddam Hussein out to be our enemy, not our great ally. And they converted him. Then we started under the policies of our Jewish-dominated administrations to boycott and literally blockade the country, and it led to the death of 1 million Iraqis. That's not according to the Iraqis. That's according to our own studies that have been made. Madeleine Albright, our Jewish Secretary of State, went on 60 Minutes, and Diane Sawyer spoke with her. And she said, you know, we're boycotting Iraq, and we're not even letting food and medicine get in there. And according to the studies that have been done by our own financed United Nations organizations, that 1 million people have died and at least 600,000 Iraqi children have died. And she's saying to her, she says, well, you know, Saddam's not suffering by this boycott. He's still got his palaces. He eats whatever he wants. He's not dying. You think killing, murdering, causing the agonizing death of 600,000 children is worth it? And our horrid little Jewish Secretary of State troll, Madeleine Albright, looked back at the cameras and she said, well, yes, we think it's worth it. And this is supposed to speak for America? It's not our government. It's their government. So, if you look at this entire problem we're facing, and I know some people, there was a lot of controversy with some of the things I said at an Amrian convention a while back, you know, and if you look at the immigration problem, I can show you from the beginning of the immigration problem up to the day who's been behind it. Kevin McDonald's also done it. It's overwhelmingly was dominated by Jews. They even write in their own publications, they take credit for it and brag about it. And they say, we're changing America from a European-American country because these Aryans can never be able to challenge our power. We'll be able to take over the politics, as they've done, for instance, in this last election, where we had no real choice. What an election from hell this last election was. Election from hell. You don't have to go to horror movies anymore. Just see what's going on in our campaigns in America. We had no choice in this election. No choice at all. We had the choice between a man who was Mr. Amnesty, a man who betrayed our people, who supports every kind of anti-white discriminatory program, and who's totally subservient to Israel and John McCain, or we have a black radical and Barack Obama. You know, either way, we'd have lost. In some ways, it's better off for us now, in a sense, because we now know who the enemy is. And Americans can see that we no longer have influence in that government. But the point... ...5 minutes and we'll eat. But the point I'm trying to make is I'm projected by the media, and a lot of our speakers are projected, as someone who's hateful or anti-Semitic or just terrible or supremacist. The truth is, we're none of those things. The truth is, our enemies are all of those things. They're warmongers. They created this incredible war in Iraq that caused 1 million Iraqis to die. And even from an American's point of view, more important, you know, 40,000 Americans maimed, lost their legs, their arms, their eyesight. Many of them never have a child, and again, because of the injuries they've suffered. Long separations, extending duty in Iraq from their homes and families. How many marriages were cost from that? You know, I mean, how many trillions of dollars? We're going to be taking care of our poor vets, you know, who've been suffering these injuries for decades ahead. Trillions of dollars to the American people. And did we get a single drop of oil out of this war? No! Nothing! And I often go to Europe, and I think I'm a good ambassador for America, because when I get up and speak on American foreign policy, I lecture on that at universities quite often. And when I lecture about American foreign policy, I point out to you, that all the students generally think, and the faculty, they generally think that this was an imperialist American war in Iraq. It was imperialism for America. And I said, look, this is not about American imperialism. America got nothing out of this war. You know, we've got 40,000 wounded. We've got more people hating America than ever before. We're spending trillions of dollars. We didn't get a drop of oil. This was only and solely a war for Israel. And we say no more wars for Israel. Now, we've got enthusiastic cheering section. Now, if you want to know why we have an abomination in this country political right now, if you want to know why, it's not because of Barack Obama, anything special about him. But the first place is the only reason why he is president, by the way, is because he's an African American. People say race didn't play a role. He couldn't have even got the Democratic nomination, except for the fact that he was black. Think about that for a fact. People say, oh, no, he's so brilliant, and he's so well-spoken, and he's so wonderful. And you ask them, and say, well, if Obama were white, and he said exactly the same things, he couldn't even got the black vote from Hillary Clinton, could he? She would have got the black vote, and she would have taken. He couldn't even have got the black vote from Hillary Clinton. He wouldn't have been president. This is an affirmative action president. Just like he had affirmative action, they got his whole career going at the law review at Harvard. He admits it himself in his own letter that he had enjoyed affirmative action. So he was put in ahead of some other deserving white student on the Harvard Law Review. He admits it himself in some of his letters. But we have been prepared for this, and we've been programmed for this for years. You know, what is Hollywood? Who are the people that run Hollywood and run our media that for years have told us that it's evil for European Americans to defend their heritage, but it's wonderful for Jews to advance theirs, and it's wonderful for Mexicans and wonderful for blacks? Who has told us that? Who runs Hollywood? You know, Well, I got an article in the Jewish Chronicle that says the four out of the five largest media conglomerates in the United States of America are owned and operated by Jews. They're bragging for their own people. And it says the fifth, which is Murdoch, and some people allege that he's Jewish. You know, I can't prove that yet, but we do know that Murdoch, that his top officials in his entire operation, the heads of Fox News and his top leaders are, in fact, Jewish extremists. And we can show more. The Chronicle itself says, yes, Fox News is even more pro-Israel than even the other ones that are owned directly, we know, by Jews. So that's the power. That's the reality. Now, a lot of people say to us, well, if we've got Jewish power in the media and government, it's just because they're smarter than we are and better than we are, and they're just more talented than we are, and that's why it exists the way it exists. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope none of you believe that. Yeah, we Gentiles, we non-Jews, we have no talents at all. We can't write a play. Of course, you can't count the work of Shakespeare. You know, we don't know anything about science or history. You know, you can't count the work of the men who developed and discovered the DNA. Men like Dr. Shockley who discovered the transistor. Newton who gave us the laws of physics the world still operates by today. You know, the great art and literature and music and writing. No, we Gentiles are just totally bereft of talent. You know, they're the only ones that have the talent. And I would just ask you, what does the Hollywood media and the television media of this movie, what do they produce in our society? What does television produce? Violence, gore, blood, degeneracy, promotion of drugs, promotion of sexual responsibility. What do they promote?
Fatalism.
Every sort of destructive tendency in the world. Just look at the movies that come out today. Just look at the values that they try to instill into our children. Is this what we're supposed to expect from these great superior people who are going to bring such loveliness to the world? They run our government. What have we done in terms of wars? You know, in my books, I show the Jewish involvement in the First World War, getting America into the war. We got into the war, and this is admitted again in Jewish publications, because the nation or the land of Palestine was promised to the Zionists in return for getting America into the war. This is admitted, the Balfour Declaration. It was a quid pro quo agreement, whereas if the Jewish media and the Jewish power in Washington and in America would get America into the war, okay, get America into the war on the British side, the deal was the British would give Israel its mandate in Palestine. So for that reason, we got a few hundred thousand Americans killed, right, in the First World War. In the Second World War, Charles Lindbergh, other heroic Americans, knew that this was a catastrophic war for Europe. The destruction of millions of Christians, the destruction of Christian churches, the destruction of priceless art, putting tens of millions of people out of their homes, taken away, having terrible injuries, death, destruction, separation, you know? And we tried, and calmer minds and spirits tried to avoid that war. My God, we should have avoided that war. And it has led directly to the terrible conditions that we have today, not only for Europe, for many parts of the world. That war, you know. So are the people that are running the world right now, are they so peace-loving, and are they bringing us art and beauty? Look at the art right now. I know you've seen some of my pictures back there. I think those are beautiful. And I think I don't want to make art that looks ugly. And yet you go into these buildings and businesses and art museums, and it looks like somebody stepped on too many things in the pasture and put them on the wall. You know, and that's reality. Ugliness is everywhere in our society. People like Paris Hilton, my God, what a scumbag, you know? Put up as an example for our kids in the teen magazines. Oh, what's Paris Hilton doing now? Maybe I can be just like her, a stupid, spoiled whore. You know? This is the values of our society, and this is what we've been bequeathed. Now, when I say they dominate Hollywood, I'm not saying anything different than they say it. Neil Gabler wrote a book called An Empire of Their Own, in which he brags about it, how they controlled Hollywood and they control our media. You know, what we're saying here is not hateful. It is not repressive. It is not supremacist. We say these things because we love decency and beauty. We love honor. We want our children to learn what honor means and duty and courage. We want our people to be safe in the street and not get hit in the head by some drug fiend who's been induced by the popularity that drugs have been made in this country by the media. We want our kids to go to school and get educated to the ultimate level of their ability and not to the lowest common denominator. We want a kid to go to school and learn about honor and duty and courage and not situation ethics or, you know, how to cheat and steal and lie your way to the top. You know, the presidency of the United States anymore, they often said, I heard this the other day on Fox News, they said, oh, it's kind of, even though we were kind of more in favor of McCain, you got to say it, you know. The American political system, the American political system selects the very best of our country. The American, let's get it straight, the system, and it's not the American system, it's the system they've imposed upon it, but the system that runs this country, you know, only lets the most corrupt to the presidency of the United States. So I want to take a couple of these moments before we eat. Hope you don't get indigestion by all this, but I want to take a couple of these moments just to explain and one more reiterate to the world, because we have to say this, because the image that they present to our people around the world is the people like myself and Don Black and our young elected Derek Black of the Republican Committee in West Palm Beach, Florida. And the brave and courageous Knut Erickson and our lovely Russian woman who gave up a career with the Kremlin, the world in front of her, to fight for our principles and be here. And all the people and all the wonderful speakers that we have here. Paul Fromm. All the people we have, and we have many more, and we're going to go into things this afternoon and have questions and answers, and we're going to go into specific discussions. We're going to have a long discussion on what's going on with Russian-American relations, which is very interesting and I think important. We'll have a long discussion about the Middle East. We're going to have a long discussion about what we can do politically in this country, about the opportunities that are now afforded to us, as what Derek's done. He will be one of our speakers today as well. We've got Jonathan Nugent here, who's a great writer. We've got a wonderful gentleman here present who's being prosecuted in Finland for standing up for his people. He's going to be a speaker. And I must tell you that Henrik and Knut, by the way, not only are they great crusaders for this cause, I hope I had some influence on them, they're both translating my books in their respective languages. So for all those listening, no matter where you are, if you listen with an open mind, I think you'll realize that I'm not, and these people at this conference are not as we've been portrayed. And that's the great thing about the Internet. That's the great power that Don's going to talk about right after lunch, is that if you ever notice, if you just read the articles in Time or Newsweek or the New York Times or the Commercial Appeals, you read the articles about me and about people like me and the cause, they always say what they say I say. They tell you what I'm supposed to represent. And then when you go to the website, and when you hear me for yourself, that's why I got 65% of the white vote in Louisiana for the U.S. Senate. When you actually have a chance to hear for yourself, not only are you convinced and you know it's the truth, but also you begin to see how the media always lies. They lie and they always lie, and the only slight truth they ever tell is to cover up a bigger lie later on. And when we get that kind of knowledge in our heart and soul and sinew of our body and our muscles and our blood and our brain, when we understand that fully, then we're going to be able to nurture and strengthen and guide the way for our people, once again, to find their freedom, their survival, and their destiny in the heavens. Thank you so much. Thanks. Is the food ready back there, everybody? All right, the food will be arrived here any moment. We've got Coca-Colas and other soft drinks available for you, and bottled water for those that need it. Thank you so much. We're going to have a great conference. We're just beginning. We got a lot to go.
Oh, yes, I've seen
all right, sorry for the sounds of rustling a microphone around, but it's a little bit haphazard. Everything is working out well today. We've been getting some record numbers, and I know there's been a lot of good activity on the thread on Stormfront. This is Theodoric, of course, Derek Black, broadcasting from Memphis, Tennessee. We're here actually on Truck Roy's computer, and Truck Roy and I'll be talking for about 10 minutes. The Euro Conference is just broken for lunch, and we're all going to go eat lunch, except we cannot leave the room because, you know, we've been besieged for a while. Dr. Duke used the analogy of the Alamo earlier, which I don't particularly like because they didn't leave the Alamo ever. But we have to hold this room because if there are a large group, well over 130, 140 people, I think some were telling me 150, are here. If we were to all leave the room, then they might just come and steal it from us and not let us back in. So, seeing as how we got in here this morning, we're not allowed to leave all at once. So a few people have to go to the bathroom can go. Otherwise, you have to stay here, and we're doing a radio show. So we want to do a little bit of commentary here. And this is Theodoric, of course, as I mentioned. And, speaking has been wonderful today. I don't want to go over the speakers because I feel like I might have missed one. I've been too busy to take notes, but I know Paul Fromm and David Duke and James Edwards have been excellent. Mr. Don Black will be speaking after lunch, after we eat our barbecued chicken. And there have been some good pictures put up. And really, in all the trials that have gone on in this conference over the last week, I am amazed that it's pulled together so well. This is one of the best conferences I've ever been to. The people here are fiery. They're enthused. They're ready, and they are all on the same page. Amazingly, they are ready for a change in America, and they are going to be involved in this future. Not just the United States, but the entire world of white people. Really, the future of our folk is possibly going to be decided here today, especially in the people who are here. Well, what more can I say? We are here in Memphis. We were not sent away, as Dr. Duke and all the other speakers have mentioned. We were not sent away. We are here under a lot more security and secrecy than before, but we are here. And we're broadcasting, and we're reaching record numbers, and the videos and the downloads will reach many hundreds of thousands more in the weeks to come after this. Right now we are live, and you're experiencing, dare I say, history. I'd actually like to turn this over to Truck Roy at the moment. He's here. He's a prominent radio host on Stormfront, and he's been helping broadcasting, make sure everything's working today. We've been using his computer and some of his expertise to make this all come together to broadcast. You know, we are in a hotel, but it is in the field. It's difficult to broadcast a lot of times. I think we do well for what we do. I want to get Truck Roy's take on the conference itself and anything I might have missed in describing the room and the 150 people who are who are in here.
Okay, Truck Roy here. Yeah, Derek exaggerates a little bit. I'm not really helping that much, but he is using my computer. I'm a bit of a computer idiot, but it's awesome here in Memphis today. It's a little cool outside. It's a nice fall day. All the leaves are turning on the trees, and we've got a lot of great patriots here in this room. We've had some good speeches. I was especially impressed by James Edwards. James Edwards just came in and really fired everybody up. He's obviously always passionate, but apparently this week he's really had to go through a lot to make this conference happen. I'm sure a lot of you out there who are listening live right now or will be listening later were aware of all the events that almost precluded this event from happening. The terrorist threats by radicals against the hotel where we were originally supposed to meet. And it was really an off and on deal that we were going to actually be able to make this happen. And everybody kept their fingers crossed, and a lot of people put in a lot of hard work, especially James and Dr. Duke, and everybody's here. I was surprised at how many people showed up despite all the troubles, and it's really been a great conference, I think even more so probably because the people who are here had to kind of go out on faith a little bit to show up and make hope that it happened, and it did, and everybody's happy to be here. As Derek mentioned, I guess we are kind of in the situation where everybody's trying to stay in the room here to make sure that we don't lose this room. We already lost the one conference center, and apparently whoever runs this hotel is not really ready to throw us out as long as we're in here. But we've got, I don't know how many folks in here. It's a good amount, and a few people are going out here and there to get some coffee or to use the restroom perhaps. But most people are just hanging tight. They all patiently waited while we set up for this event, which took a good amount of time. And, you know, the other thing that I find amazing is that all the speakers showed up. We have folks from Finland, folks from Denmark, Europe, Russia, and all these people came here, saw all the hassles that James and Dr. Duke went through to make this happen, and they didn't flake out. They hung tough. I'm sure they face a lot of discrimination over in their own countries for their political views, and we, of course, face some adversity here in America, too. But I have a real good feeling about this. I mean, of course, we're undergoing a lot of hassles right now, but that's because the potential is so strong right now. With the election of Barack Hussein Obama to office, we have a real awakening here in the United States. Perhaps in the next few months and years, we'll see it even over in Europe, where people are saying, wait a minute, who's running the show here? And just that name, Barack Hussein Obama, I mean, that sounds like somebody that we were fighting over in the Middle East for the last few years. And so a lot of Americans are really kind of shaking their heads and saying, wait a minute. And they're a lot more open to our message right now, which our message is pretty easy to sell. It's just white pride and to stand up and claim our nation and our heritage and not like let anyone else take that away from us. So I think the audience is there for what we're trying to do right now. And as much hassle as this conference has been, I think we're going to have a lot of wind at our backs here in the future. It's kind of a turning point. I was listening to some radio when I was driving down here to Memphis, and I was listening to some of the nationally broadcast sort of neocon talk show hosts, and they understand that the BS that they've been selling in its current form or in the form that it's been during the Bush administration is not selling anymore. And they're moving their message around a little bit. I specifically heard Rush Limbaugh really go after this chief of staff for Barack Obama. Hey, Derek, what's the name of that chief of staff for Barack Obama?
Rahm Emanuel.
And this fellow's a Jewish guy, and I was amazed to hear Rush Limbaugh really going after him and mentioning that he was Jewish and his close ties with Axelrod and some other Jewish people in Obama's administration. So I think that when you have mainstream people going out and doing that, you know, obviously Limbaugh is not on the same page with us on so many issues. But he does mention that whenever you say something politically incorrect against a black or against a Jew, they call you haters, they call you racists. And they're painting all of us with that brush, whether it's white nationalists here who really have a firm idea of what we're talking about and really are holding true to our founding fathers, or whether you're talking about someone who's compromised a bit with Rush Limbaugh. They're all painting us with the same brush. The radical leftist media is nailing us all with these labels. And that gives us a great opportunity to bring in so many of our people who have been a little bit off track. And right now, they're being called haters. They're being called racist, just as we are. And so they're going to say, well, wait a minute. Maybe
it's not, you know, if they're going to call me a racist anyway, maybe I should stand up for my race. So I think that's something that a lot of the speakers are hitting on here today, and I think we're going to hear a lot more of it after the lunch break here. Derek, are we going to be playing some music during?
We're going to be replaying some of the speeches. We'll be replaying some of the speeches from earlier.
Okay, so we're going to go back to the replays of some of the highlights of the great speeches that we've heard, and we'll have fresh live speeches coming right after a short lunch break here. We're all just kind of hunkered down, hanging tight in this room, and making this thing happen. Thank you, all of you, for listening out there, and all of you that are going to be catching us on the download later. There will be more conferences. There will be more events like that, and you too can be here. Derek, you want to go ahead and fire that up?
I'll take it over anyway. Now, that's on the download, not on the down low.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify that, because I turned around, and I looked at Trucker, and I said, what? Catch you on the down low? What? Then I thought about it. I said, no. Yeah, we will be broadcasting all throughout this day. I was told it would go off into the evening tonight, and so, well, I don't know. We may be going off into the sunset, into the Nacht, as the Germans say. But for now, we'll be replaying some of the earlier speeches, and within 30 minutes, perhaps 45, we'll be back with live speeches. And we have a lot of great speakers today, and a lot of things to be said, and a lot of things to do. So we'll be returning to you under 45 minutes, but more than likely about a half an hour from now, so you can do what you wish, or you can listen to some of the speeches that were recorded earlier today. I guarantee you they're very good, particularly if you missed them the first time and you'd like to tune in and hear what was said earlier. That is Dr. David Duke, James Edwards, people from around the world, some very interesting speeches. All right, we'll be back in about 30 minutes. Talk to you then. This is Theodoric signing out from Memphis.